bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hi, welcome to the Photo Show with Forsman stuffing his gob, as ever. We're here to discuss the week's photographic news. I'm Ewan Rankin, and joining me, fantastic panel, top left, Chris Forsman of Ars Technica and Guru, nay, on photography. Back on crappy cam, I see, mate.
Sorry.
Bugger.
Sorry.
You had to give it back, the Retina display.
Actually, I have it sitting over here, but it's running Windows right now for some...
Oh, dear.
Boot camp tests, though.
So. Right, okay. Are those tests going to take an awful long time?
Well, only because I have to go back and forth between doing work over here and testing something over there and coming back to do some work here. So,
never mind. No. Mr. Newsom is joining us again. Kevin Newsom from Tampa, Florida, Master Photographer. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you back on, mate. We had some audio issues last time getting through to you, but we're going to have you. You should come on more regularly now if we've got this sorted out and it all works and you understand Alex.
As long as I can understand Alex, I think I'll be okay. Cool.
As long as you could type up subtitles for the rest of us, that's all that matters. And talking to the devil, Mr. Alex G. Fox of East London.
Yes, Mr. Ewan Rankin, formerly of Nottinghamshire.
How are you doing, pal?
I'm all right, you know. I've done some work, I've earned some money, and I've had lots of rest because I wasn't well. But now I actually feel really good because it's the first time in 2 weeks.
You missed the bash, dude.
Oh, you know, I'm still rather miffed about that.
It's all right. We played your song. Everyone loved your song.
It's very kind of them.
It was, yeah. The Week in Photography. We'll start off with the first thing then. Nikon has filed a patent for an optical low-pass filter. Now, your low-pass filter is dealing with moiré and Gaussian aberrations and that kind of stuff going in and kind of interpreting edges, that type of stuff. So, now that's an electronic filter, I'm right in saying, on your camera. But so why are you now going to go for an optical version of the same thing? What's the benefit? I mean, someone's put under here a brilliant idea. I don't know who that is, but...
That's me.
Right. Explain to us, Alex, why that's a brilliant idea, please.
Well, first of all, it's not, as far as I understand, it's not an electronic filter. It's actually a physical piece of glass with various very clever bits and pieces on it. You know, the only trouble with... a low-pass filter is it actually can and does slightly lessen the sharpness of your image. Nikon's new, the reason they're doing this, their new D800 comes in two versions, which is the D800 and D800E. And the E, which is very strange, you actually pay more money because it doesn't have something on it and it doesn't have this filter. And what they're doing here is maybe they're not going to do it straight away, but they've patented the idea of bringing out lenses which have the filter on it. So you then actually have the choice of whether to use a low-pass filter or not. Because at the moment, you have to use one camera or another camera if you want it or you don't want it. Now, this gives you the option. Now, the low-pass filter is useful, but only in certain circumstances. There's a lot of circumstances that you'll get a sharper and slightly higher resolution if you haven't got a filter, and so you'd only need this lens for certain shots. So what it's just giving you options that you've never had before. And I used both cameras this week, the E and the 800, and at first I couldn't see the difference between the E and the 800, and then it was all set up with me to do a different test shot, and with the setup of the second test shot I could see the difference. So it's only within very small parameters that it makes a difference. But for I imagine this is going to be fairly expensive. And for a high-end setup, if they maybe bring it out on the new, say they bring out a D5 with the option of not having the low-pass filter, then this would be very, very useful. And I'd just say the D800s, from what I've said, they're almost up there with medium format, but not quite, because of you've got the resolution, but you don't quite get the sharpness you get with a medium format. But this option on a D5 with the same system as the D800E would be medium format, and I don't think you could tell the difference.
Chris, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with what Alex is saying there. I mean, the idea is then if you want the low pass or need the low pass feature, you can get it in the lens. If you don't need it, then you can, you know, take advantage of greater sharpness. You know, and this isn't really the only patent Nikon has on, you know, dealing with low pass filters. They have another one that is kind of designed to put basically a switch or a preference in camera, and then they've got sort of a mechanical thing that moves the filter out of the way. But that kind of system is going to be much more complex, expensive to implement and implement well. Here, the what's brilliant about putting it in the lens is that the lens can be designed and optimized with that low pass filter in mind, and then a lens, you know, then they don't have to account for it, you know, with lenses that don't have that low pass filter, and then you're always going to get, you know, an optimum sharpness depending on the lens you use. You know, the body's always going to, you know, give you the greatest sharpness depending on the lens.
Kevin, any thoughts?
Well, I'm in the portrait world, so I don't really have a need for it. I would go with, you know, between the 800 and the 800E, I'd go with the 800. My images are going to be sharp enough. I don't need them to be any sharper than that. People are, you know, tending to find better actions and reasons to make them soft again. But and I remember using diffusion in the film days, so, you know, I don't really need to go as sharp as an 800E would be. And so the filter really wouldn't work for me. It might work in the commercial world, but it doesn't work so much in the portrait world.
I mean, I would have thought, Alex, that sharpening for you would be something you would want to have absolute control over rather than it being something that was applied by the filter itself alone.
No, the thing is, what this does, I mean, you are completely right, but this doesn't sharpen anything. This just gives you the sharpest optical choice there is. It's nothing. There's nothing about this that this is doing electronically. This is just giving you, without the low. Basically, when you shoot with a camera, once you put a low pass filter between the lens and the actual sensor, you lose a percentage of sharpness.
Well, it's attenuation. You're attenuating a specific light frequency. And attenuating edges, that kind of stuff.
But the thing is, the low-pass filter is actually designed to do that. It's specifically to do what you're talking about. It's not there, and a side effect of it is unsharpening it. It's actually designed to unsharpen. Just to explain, when you've got things like a net curtain, when you've got parallel lines and they're very close together, if you don't have a low-pass filter, you get the moiré pattern, or you get artificial colours that come into the picture. Yep. That's how it works. And this is actually designed to slightly unfocus or unsharpen those parts of the picture. So you're not actually adding sharpness. This is the true sharpness of your image. Then you can soften it if you want to artificially after. I mean, you don't actually need a low-pass filter. You can do it electronically in Photoshop.
Yeah, I mean, I would say
varying degrees of success.
Yeah.
Well, generally, I mean, I would always sharpen it, depending on the output. If you're someone's saying, like, I've got a PowerPoint presentation coming up, I want a picture of this item, and it's only going to go in PowerPoint, blown up to, you know, 50 inches on a screen or something, then you'd sharpen it a bit harder because of the fact of the light and because of the fact it's a low resolution to start with when it's being projected. But, the sharpening element of images is something that digital cameras have always been that soft because of that low pass filter. And there was a guy the other month took the low pass filter off the D5, didn't he, and shot video with it and got super crisp video. But once you've got that, it's very difficult to then think about it, whether that's sharpened is the way that you want it. And that's the key part, it's the controllability.
Sure, but it's like saying, I mean, like when you go to work, you could probably use a pretty low-end lens for some of the work you do.
I do.
But you also choose to use your very good, very expensive lens. Say when you're doing your sports photography. Now, you could get a fast lens that isn't quite as good as the lens you use, but you choose to use the best lens you can afford because you want to start off with the best picture possible. Then you can make it thumbnail size if you want, or do what you want with it.
Yeah.
But the trick is to start off with the best you can start off with and then play around with it. And this is what this is doing. It's giving you the very best optical picture you can get. And then if you want to do something with it afterwards, then fine. But it's like artificial sharpening is never as good as actually having it as sharp as you can in the first place.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's again, Kevin, you were saying about the fact of thinking that you know, you're actually starting softer is okay for you.
Yeah, it is. You know, and I have dealt with moiré patterns in businessmen's suits all, you know, ever since the beginning of digital. And I can remember the frustration before there were filters that fixed it. And I was thrilled that it sped up my workflow once the cameras got better and you didn't pick up the moiré pattern as much. Yes, I know you can fix it in Photoshop. Trust me, I'm an old school guy. I want to keep that workflow as quick as possible. Have to mess with it in the post-production. So I just as soon let the camera handle it. My images are sharp. I've got billboards on the highway. I sell 40-50s and I don't have any problem with the sharpness. So on portrait world, it's fine, really. You know, I hate to use the term good enough because that's become a punchline these days, but I do not need my portrait images to be any sharper than they are. So I'm fine with without the filter.
Yeah.
Or with the filter.
Okay. Next issue, Canon has issued some allergy warnings for its EOS 650D Rebel T4i. That's the two between the UK and the US. Same model though. The rubber hand grips of some models may turn white and produce a chemical that can cause an allergic reaction.
Now, it's funny now because since that came out, it's been floating around the internet and blogs and Facebooks that how do you spot a faux photographer? They're the ones with the red bumps around one eye. So, you know it's bad press for Canon big time, and I sure hope they deal with it quickly. I don't know exactly how they're resolving it, but that's bad news for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a website where you can actually put in your serial number of your T4i/650D, and it will tell you whether your camera is affected or not. It's obviously a batching issue, I would have thought, some kind of fixer or something gone into the plastic that's caused the problem, but. I've not heard anyone or seen anyone complaining about this. Chris, you had anything to Ars Technica where anyone's written in?
No. Okay. No, I read the same kind of things that you have, that Canon identified the problem pretty much right away. And that they, you can get a replacement, so taking care of people.
Nikon would never do this, would they, Alex?
No, but it is nice to know that there's finally a camera company that sends out surgical gloves with every unit.
Right, before we get any further Canon bashing then. Miticon has released a 35mm lens that f-stops at 0.95, not even one. Coming soon. First images are shot and up and ready. 35mm was always kind of the perfect lens, wasn't it? When you went and bought your my dad's got a Kodak camera at home and it's got a fixed 35mm lens on it. $940 for this. I've never used any Miticon lenses. Has anyone?
They are an OEM for SLR Magic. I don't know if you've heard. Yeah. They make these. They're just kind of old school, like all metal barrels and big heavy lenses, but they make like this.
They look well made.
50, yeah. They make a 50 f 0.95 too. I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a Canon. I'm trying to remember when this was, but it was a Canon, maybe even a Canonette, but it had a fixed lens, and it wasn't an SLR. It was like a rangefinder. That they made, I want to say like in the 60s, maybe early 70s. But it came with a fixed 50 0.95 lens, and it was like, the brightest lens in the world, and you couldn't get a lens for shooting in low light any better than this. But the thing was so enormous, and as you can see, like this, it's a single focal length lens, and it's easily like four times the size and weight of the camera that it's on.
Yeah, it's on the, fixed on the Sony Micro Four Thirds.
Yeah. So I'm willing to, I mean, I'd say for someone who just shoots a ton of low light, it's probably worth the money. But I sort of feel like if I spent the money on one, it would be more just for kind of like the coolness of like, hey, I've got this 0.95 lens.
Do you remember Centon lenses? Centon? Centon. They were cheap and yet relatively nasty lenses, it has to be said. But they were all metal barrels and stuff like that. They were really, really well made. Just the glass was crap. But they were. That's what this reminded me of when I saw them. There's several on eBay. There's loads on eBay. That's where they seem to do most of their sales. Anyone else had a go with these, Kevin?
I've never heard of them before
today.
Yesterday, the Metacon. So I did a little digging on them. I found them on eBay, $1,400 US for that lens. At what point does it run out of room for depth of field? I mean, that thing's got to be pretty shallow if you're at 0.95, don't you think?
Yeah, pupil in focus, iris out of focus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alex, any thoughts? Would you buy one of these?
No, I thought they fought the Klingons in the first episode of Star Trek.
Well, the Miticons.
Yeah.
No, that was the one on Dan Dare, wasn't it?
It might well have been. My memory is not as good as it used to be. I was in a shop in... I was in town anyway, and I was in a shop. It was a second-hand shop, and I picked up an old, I think it was a 200mm, and it was probably 20 years old, and it was completely all metal construction. And I'll tell you what, I'm glad things have changed. There's no way I could even use that on a camera. You'd need to work out for 6 months before you could actually swing that thing around and take pictures. Oh, it was amazing. But no, I haven't heard of Metacon.
Good. Me either until today.
I mean, there's other Chinese OEMs like Samyang, I think, is one. Cosina was a Japanese one. Although I think a lot of their stuff is manufactured in China now. Here in the States, they were commonly rebadged and sold by Phoenix and Vivitar. Two common brand names that sold these type of lenses.
They're well built. I mean, they're expensive. So now we're all. This is the one we've been waiting for. This is the story. Now, and we're all going to lech at this, but no one's going to buy it. Nikon have released or have announced that they have gone official on an 800mm lens. It's a f/5.6, and they're going to launch it at the Open Golf Championship at Lancashire at Lytham St Annes this week. So.
I hope it's really robust if they're going to launch it.
Launch it, yeah, out of a cannon.
No, it has to be out of a Nikon.
I've had a go with...
you can afford an Nikon body to put on it.
I had a go with Sigma 800mm lens years ago at a golf tournament, and I loved it, but it was... I mean, the only problem you get is the aberrations with that kind of stuff. When you get up to the super zooms, you tend to find that stuff that's really in the background just starts to fall apart and look really like it's been dissolved in water for a month, even if your subject's sharp. There's no price on this either, which is a bit disappointing. But would impressed, unimpressed? Buy it, wouldn't buy it?
I couldn't think of a single reason why I'd need one.
No.
But if I had loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of money, I'd definitely have at least two of them.
Basically,
If I was a bird watcher or a grizzly bear shooter, maybe, but
right.
not practical in my world.
Grizzly bear shooter, you'd want that with a 2x converter, though, wouldn't you? Take it up to f/8.
you're talking wildlife and sports are your 99.99% of your buyers for this lens.
Sit up in a hide.
Well, even in the sports world, you're... Fortunately, if you're outside, like golf or football or something like that, you still got to be at a shutter speed of 1600. You can't take tripods into these sporting events, so you've got to use a monopod, and even that doesn't hold it still enough. So, if you're in the bright daylight, okay, you can get away with a 2/1000th of a shot. You're going to need a fast shutter speed to catch Tiger Woods' swing anyway, but that's a lot of lens to be hand-holding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, the other thing that I think with the sports lenses, I've done it with the Moon, is I've got a 2.8 200mm lens from Canon, And I've had 3 2x converters on that, which has got it up to 1600. And I've shot a picture of the moon handheld just for fun. And it's crap. It's awful.
That started off as such an interesting anecdote. And then it didn't work.
I got a half decent picture. I managed to get it. Well, the best I could do with it on 800 ISO was I managed to get it down to a 15th of a second and shot it handheld. And I nearly got it still. Nearly. Not quite. If you put 2 2x converters on, you've got to be prepared you're going to go for manual focus. But if you're if you're not blind like me, then you can get away with shooting at 800mm. You're only going up to f8 there at that point, don't forget, with your 2x expansion. So at 5.6, it's already starting pretty high up anyway. And as you say, Kev, you're going to have a pretty good day at 800 ISO. But, I mean, the only thing you'll say is, I suppose, that it's going on the Nikons. Nikons are dealing with low light an awful lot better than any of the brands still at the moment, aren't they? So, you know, the 1600s, the 3200 exposures for ISO are a lot more feasible now. So
If you were using a D4, no question.
Yeah.
But and then with a D4, then it might balance out that lens a little bit, too.
Yeah.
So.
D4 and a brick.
I'll tell you what's really interesting. I saw a write-up on this lens yesterday, maybe the day before. And they actually complained that the maximum aperture is only f5.6. Mm. And apparently they don't understand that it's a ratio of the focal length to that diameter. And, you know, even full frame cameras have a physical limit as far as how big that opening can get for the lens to go into.
Yeah.
I mean,
I suppose you could have a 3-foot opening at the front as well.
Yeah, right. You could, but then you'd have to have a special camera to hook onto it. I mean,
I think the Canon 800, do Canon do 800? I know they do a 6, but I can't remember if they do an 8.
Do 12. 100.
No, I know they did 12, and we talked about before we started about the fact that was a custom build, though. But I mean, I thought the 1200 was an f8.
Yeah, that's right. Probably
yeah,
$10,000 as well.
Oh, and the rest, it was custom build, mate. I mean, I think the 600mm comes out at nearly 10 at f4. So
well, and you guys have heard of this. Nikon 1200 to 1700 zoom, right?
We're the very next story on the list. Thank you for the segue, sir. Go ahead.
So in 1990, Nikon made a handful of prototypes, I guess, that it gave to Japanese newspaper photographers. But it was a 1200 to 1700 5.6 to 8 zoom lens.
Bazooka.
Yeah. It is a photographic bazooka, exactly.
So we're showing a picture on the video stream at the moment. There are two young ladies sat by a fountain, but you can see supposedly how far we are at 50mm maybe, and then the picture of them. And it's not a particularly good picture to start with, but that is what I was talking about earlier on with zoom. If you get super zooms, and particularly if you start putting 2x converters on, you start to get things in the long distance start to really look like they're torn pieces of sugar paper or something. It looks very unnatural, and the two girls aren't sharp in that image.
I think they dress quite nicely.
Thank you, sir.
Quite agree.
Would you buy it? To be fair as well, it's 1200 for f5.6, and it goes up to 8 f8 if you're on 1700. Was there a value on these lenses, or did they just genuinely give them away?
No, I think they sold them by weight.
Don't you just love how far forwards the handle is because the glass is so big on this thing? That's the point of balance
really
right there.
You'd have really long arms to take a picture with that camera, wouldn't you?
That camera, I think, shoots any picture you take, you're actually capturing light 20 minutes in the future.
Yep, it's a quantum lens.
I think you can photograph Japanese baseball games from your home in San Francisco.
Jolly good. Well worth having. Get the space center. Can you imagine trying to track the space center at 17,000 miles an hour as it's going over? And the last story, if you've got into your iPhoneography, and we had an iPhoneographer come to the MASH last week, and then she left after the photo show. but this is a dolly for your steady cammy type stuff for your iPhone.
Any dolly.
Now, Grant, who did all the video last week, he shot tons and tons of video at the bash. He's had a go at making up his own little travel dolly on rails. And he's used skate wheels just like this. I mean, is anyone tempted?
No.
I'm not. I rarely shoot video.
I'm shooting more video. I've been doing a few videos just lately, and I'm starting to think about getting more into it, and I'm really enjoying it.
But if you use this dolly, you'd only be able to video people's feet anyway.
You can use it on tables. I mean, it's
not... getting low down.
I knew there was something I was missing.
That would be cool. I'd love to have a little curved dolly that you could track the camera around from left to right while you were interviewing people, and them get distracted by it and go off tangent.
Do you reckon they get the name Dolly from Trolley Dolly?
I've no idea. So no one's buying this then?
No, my kids have got similar things, but they ride around the garden on them.
It's only $60. Come on. There's a picture of Montmartre on it as well, in the little video of them tracking with it. You can use it anywhere.
If I shot video of any seriousness, I would definitely consider it. I mean, it's a clever device. The price is decent, but you know, I'm too busy thinking about how am I going to buy it. Mark III or
iPhone video, mate. 1080p quality's excellent.
Sure.
I've bought a helicopter, and I'm gonna stick my iPhone in a helicopter and shoot 1080p video out of it corporately.
Blimey. I know you said you'd had a couple of good months, but that's ridiculous.
No, helicopter this big, not helicopter 40 foot across.
Okay.
So. I don't use video at all in my business. I can do slideshows and occasionally splice videos into them for high school seniors, but it's not a huge part of my business, so it's not a priority for me. If I got the D800, I'd probably find a way to use it because I'd paid for it, but I don't think it's not the reason I'd buy that camera.
I'm loving it at the minute. I shot a video on an oil leak thing the other week for a firm. They said, we've got this new oil leak suppression system. Can you shoot a video? So, yeah, all right. Crack the valve open and then switch the machine off. And then when you turn the machine back on, it'll go poof, like it's burst. And I got covered. Absolutely covered. Did I talk about that the other week?
Probably, but it's
I got a piece
funny.
Of oil. I got a bit of oil on my lens. One blob of oil, and I cleaned it off and it's fine. All that rubbish about coatings on your lenses and crap like that did not.
Yeah, well, they're oil coatings, so you're all right. If you'd have got hit with water, you'd have been in trouble.
Yeah, that's it.
Just quickly, let me just say, I played with the D800 the other day. Right, just
we know.
Just to say, what really did impress me, and it probably will impress you just for the fact, I took a picture in the studio I was in, and it was all quite nicely lit and everything, and I played with it, and I went up to 6400, and I took a picture. And I thought, God, that's really quick, and it's not particularly grainy, and that's really very good. But, you know, there was a load of light. I literally got them to turn the lights off, and there was a few Macs in the background, a bit of ambient light, and that was it. And I took the same picture, and it literally came out identically.
Wow.
There was no noise at all. And it was jaw-dropping, because I really thought, you know, I know they make claims on this camera, but it can't be all that. I mean, it can be good, but it can't. I was blown away, and I would say anyone that's got to do low light photography, at least go and play. And that wasn't even the E, that was the 800 itself, which hasn't got such good low light. And I'd never seen anything like that on I've never seen any. I played with the D4 as well, and it was the same as the D4, and you're talking about £2,500. I was absolutely blown away.
How's the workflow change when you're working with an 800?
Well, see, to me, it doesn't make an awful lot of difference because I might take 20 or 30 pictures in a day because each picture I take is a setup shot and I take a picture. I mean, if you're actually taking a few, you know, taking portraits and you're trying to decide what the best angle is and what you're doing, then you've got an awful lot of stuff to play with. Even if you're just playing with 35 megabyte RAW files, you're still talking about big files. But for me, I tend to just look at them in bridge and then just only ever touch the ones that I want because mine are set up shots because I work with artworks or pack shots, so there's not a problem. For me, it makes no difference whatsoever.
Is the download time, you know, from your card considerably longer?
Well, it's not considerably because I tend to fill up a card in a day maybe anyway. So I'm always going to download the whole card. But remember, this is USB 3. So as you know, it's got the standard in there. So if you do have a USB 3 machine, I think the new Macs are going to be USB 3, and obviously a lot of the PCs are anyway. You know, it's going to be noticeably quicker anyway. But I would have said, it depends. How long does it take you to download a card now? I mean, I do an 8, depending on what card it is and how well my Mac's behaving, an 8 gig or 16 gig card only takes a couple of minutes anyway. It's just a good time to go and put the kettle on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I tend to, if I'm doing anything with anything, it tends to be shoot a bit and then make sure I've got that backed up so I've got it in two separate places. And then when I get it on the laptop, I back it up to the second drive as well as, and I never overwrite the card until the following day when I know I've got two sorted out. So I tend to shove it in the machine and dump photos down at the end of, you know, someone does an interview, I shoot a couple of dozen shots. And if there's a lull in the fighting while they're moving something around, I'll take the opportunity to dump it down then. So there's always a couple of minutes going. Yeah. I think it may be different for you, Kev, with having people sat around while you do that process. You'd like it to be a bit quicker so that you can see them instantaneously so that they can get a feel of what you've shot before they leave, perhaps. But for me, commercially, it's something that I've always got that time.
Yeah. I mean, I'd advise Chris, you know, when you're doing your gig shots, go and get a unit to just do a demo on or something, and go and shoot in your low light. It is absolutely extraordinary.
There you go. There's your challenge for you, mate. Come and show us when you've done it. Six things. Which six tools, tips, or tricks would be employed to take a really good family portrait? I think you should be doing this on your own, Kev. So,
well, yeah, I know. It was to the purpose for that question was to avoid winding up on awkwardfamilyphotos.com. Number one tip would be never upload your photos to the internet. You know, but that would pretty much guarantee it'll never show up. But, you know, simple tips, coordinate your clothing, number one, because that's the biggest problem you'll see in a lot of that. It's just clothing consultation would have kept some of those images off of that website. Find a suitable location, a comfortable composition, hire somebody to do it. Don't do it with a self timer. And no gimmicks or overuse of Photoshop. You see a lot of that on that website as well. There's a lot of Photoshop faux pas on that website, and they're hysterical. They're a lot of fun and very entertaining. I actually have the book. Somebody gave it to me for Christmas. But I study it so I know what not to do. But those are, you know, some pretty solid tips. Clothing consultation and hire a pro.
I never bother to check what people are wearing just in case I turn up and I don't match. Oh, no, you're talking about the people sitting, aren't you?
Oh, thank you, mate. Chris, got anything to add?
I used to do, when I was a wee lad and first trying to crack into doing professional photography, I used to do a lot of these portraits where people want to be in their home. And, you know, honestly, like I had the most basic of gear. I had a couple flashes with optical slaves. I mean, this was before even like the Canon wireless TTL system and things like this were even around. So I had to do all this stuff kind of manually. And it was on film, so I couldn't see my results right away. I had to wait and develop the film and hope it came out right. And it was hard, but it's even like Kevin said, look around your scene, think of every detail and anticipate, you know, what the impact's going to be. So I think that's really what it boils down to. As far as gear goes, you want a slightly longer lens than usual. Something with a shallow aperture. You can, you know, control your depth of field, move people away from the background. I know like people take pictures at home all the time, and the thing that I see is they stand right directly behind a wall, and then a person stands all the way at the other end of the room and take their picture. So I would say move them, you know, 5 to 10 feet away from the background, get as close to them as possible, fill the frame. And if it doesn't work out, just hire a pro. I mean, there are plenty of pros who will come over to your house and shoot pictures for you wherever you want.
I think the thing as well, the beauty of again, being in digital world, is the fact that you've got that ability to mess around and play around. I did a family 2 years ago. I don't do a lot of portrait photography, but we were all sat around in the living room trying to make it look decent, and it's a horrible white living room with awful chairs and that kind of stuff. And you're like, well, let's go in the garden. And they said, well, but it's dark. Well, yeah, but I got flashlights and they'll work outside. So, and then just at the end, I put on a really wide angle lens, stepped back, and I said, let's take a picture of you having your picture taken, and left the lamps in there on the umbrellas. And it was the best shot of the lot by a long way. So, you know, don't be afraid to mess around and see what you get out. I've had a great family shot a couple of years ago where people pressed their face against some glass and I shot it from outside. They were inside. They loved it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'd say is don't go straight for it. I mean, I did some recently as a favour to someone, and the first half an hour was a couple of grumpy kids and parents being a bit annoyed that the kids weren't doing what they were told. And I was like, look, here's some toys for the kids. Here's a cup of tea for you. Here's some cakes. Let's just mess around for half an hour. Because if they wanted to get on with it, and I was like, you know, if the kids don't want to be there and someone doesn't look happy, and you're wasting your time. Why bother? So we just waited half an hour. The kids were happy. They'd had something to eat. They'd had something to drink. They'd had a bit of fun. I joked around with them. I'd let them take a few pictures of me and things like that, just so they were getting excited about the camera. They turned out to be some really lovely pictures, especially the kids, because the laughs on the kids' faces were completely natural.
Mm.
And so that was the thing. Don't steam in there. You know, build up the ambience of the situation, and you know, have fun. Because nothing says a family picture more than people being happy. I mean, that was the thing with this website. Some of the grumpy buggers on this website—they really didn't want to be there.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right, Alex. It's a case of people make their decisions on which image to purchase based on expression. All that other stuff becomes secondary, but the expression is what sells it. If they're having a good time, it's going to show up. It's going to be worthy of a family portrait. But to keep it off that website, you know, that's where the details come in. Because you see a lot, there was one that was floating around yesterday of a family that stacked one on top of the other. And they were completely nude, the entire family. And there were six people in this photograph. Dad, mom, and four kids all stacked on top of each other, completely nude.
The trouble is the one at the front wasn't smiling.
They were all smiling. It was the funniest part because they looked happy. And I thought, what a wonderful family portrait for a nudist colony, but not necessarily for, you know, you don't want to put that on the internet. But
all social services.
Moving on swiftly. questions. First questions from Trevor in Coventry. Hi, everyone. Thanks for the shows, which I've been listening to several months now. I've got a question about iFi cards. Does the panel think they're worthwhile purchases, and has anyone used them? Also, how fast are they uploading the really big images? Anyone used an iFi card?
Only very briefly.
I have one.
I have an 8 gig iFi.
Those are for SD cards, are they not? I use all CFs. I don't use SDs. Do they make them for CF?
No. It's all SD.
I haven't used them.
Chris?
I've used mine. It come in real handy when I'm doing live blogging, because I have an Olympus pen that I've taken to some conferences, and it doesn't shoot tethered. But, you know, the iFi, I just link it to my computer, and there's a little app that it comes with, and it'll just automatically download each image to a folder for you. What we do is, you know, we have a workflow. So I have a watch folder. I have the iFi send the images there automatically. Then I have basically like a script, an app that runs, and it looks for that watch folder. It sizes it automatically. It adds an Ars Technica watermark to it. It moves it to a Dropbox folder, so it sends it up to our. And then someone, you know, in the office will basically monitor that Dropbox folder, and they'll post the images to our live blog. So it works out really nice.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'd say with them is that you've got to watch out for firmware updates on your camera. So when you update the software for the iFi, unless you've got the latest firmware for your camera, sometimes you get issues of them actually not sending the images through. But I've got an 8 gig one. I don't use it very often as a link. And the other thing that's nice is if you've got Macs is that you can create your own Wi-Fi hotspot off your own Mac antenna. And it's a closed loop for just you and the camera then. So the camera's just got complete bandwidth straight to your Mac. And then if you've got a hardwire connection for your Mac or your Wi-Fi is plugged in as a broadband connection instead of having to use the airport, then that process of flowing them up to the internet is significantly easier. But very, very good. Very, very good. Alex, used them?
Only briefly, because I was trying them out, and as it's already been mentioned, they don't, well, for the technical reasons, they only make them SD. And none of my proper equipment, shall we say, takes SD, because all Nikon just use compact flash. I do notice, funnily enough, the 800 has both. So that was something I was talking to them about. Would it sort of do a copy from one to the other and also give me the ability to use an iFi card, and they ummed and ahed, but they thought it would be possible. So that might be something that I would, you know, think of in the future. I mean, the beauty remembering an iFi card, it still works as a card. So, yeah. You know, even if you've, you know, it's an 8 gig card, and I'm sure they're going to do bigger and faster ones. And also they've got GPS functionality now as well, haven't they? So there's something that's being updated all the time. So yeah. I think they're an incredibly good value piece of equipment.
They're not
as well.
That expensive, no, absolutely. Just finished Trevor's last bit there. The how fast do they upload the images? If you've got a closed loop with your Mac, they're pretty much a couple of seconds. They're nothing at all. The other thing you've got is continuous shooting. So when you've filled the card, it'll still keep transmitting to the camera. It doesn't say that there's a card full error. So that's the last thing that's really, really good with it. Question two. Hello, Ewan, Alex, and Chris. And Kevin as well, but didn't say that, from Sylvia in Chelmsford. Although I love playing with my point-and-shoot camera, I have a Canon G9, I still seem to suffer from camera shake and thus blurred images. I know this is such a simple thing to correct, and you'll probably say, just hold the camera steady, but I do really try, and I still get fuzzy images all the time. I know this because, and it is all me, I know this because if I use a tripod, the images are fine. Can you share any tips with me that I might use to try and get a steadier shot? Kev, do you want to start us off, sir?
G9 is a manual camera, so I would put it in shutter priority and set the shutter speed to a minimum of 400th of a second, okay? Because that thing has a zoom lens of 35 to 210. So if you put it to shutter priority and at least a 400th of a second, you should reduce any camera shake that you may have from handheld. That's the biggest thing. If you have to increase your ISO in order to get to a 400th of a second, but it, shutter speed is everything when you're hand holding, and you've got to be double the at least double the focal length. So if you're shooting at 210, you want to be, you know, at least at 400.
Okay, Alex, anything to add?
No, I think that completely covers it. I don't know what the low noise, you know, the noise ratio on a G9 is, but it's probably not that bad. Just whack your ISO up a bit, you know, 800 to 1,000 as a minimum if you're having problems, and then stick it on shutter priority. There's nothing that will solve your problem, full stop.
Chris?
I'm really curious, too, because the G9 had optical image stabilization. You know, my first...
You must be getting it really wrong.
Yeah, I thought like maybe the G9 was just didn't have image stabilization yet, and maybe you can try, you know, like a G11 or G12. The G10 sensor was not very good in low light, so that would really not help you at all. But the G11 and G12 sensors are much more sensitive to low light. They still have an optical image stabilized zoom. But the G9 was a good camera, and I'm really just kind of... I'll tell you, I have a friend who's a pro, but he has a nervous condition where, like, hands shake all the time.
The yips.
And he sometimes was having really trouble, like, shooting in low light and things like that, and he got image-stabilized lenses, and it really just changed his photography. You know, but the G9's got that, so I can't really... Like Kevin said, crank your shutter speed, shoot shutter priority, and make sure your shutter speed's always fast. Or, you know, what might also help is kind of analyze, are you getting shake in all images? Are you getting shake only when it's zoomed in a lot? You know, all those images you can go through and look at the shutter speeds and apertures and even the zoom lens settings, I'm pretty sure. it'll tell you if you look in the XF data. So maybe looking at that and seeing, you know, my ISO is too low, my shutter speeds aren't high enough. You know, it only happens when the lens is really long, and that's when you need to really kind of focus on some more manual settings. Other than that, I'm sort of at a loss what to suggest.
Yeah,
can't use a tripod all the time. It's just practical.
Thing I would say, Sylvia, is when you're taking you want to use the camera, look on the dial on the top, because that'll tell you what mode you're in. And there's a chance that you've got it sat in manual, which means that when you put it on a tripod, it means regardless almost of whatever you've got there, you've got a chance of actually exposing it steadily. And it might just by chance be actually on a reasonably correct exposure, but not the shutter priority, as Kev says. Look on the back of the live view when you're ready to take the image, and part press the shutter without pressing full through, and then see what the figures are that they give you. And as Kevin says there, the shutter priority, which would be TV, will say X uth of a second, and look for the figure that Kev gave you. And if you're having trouble as well, look on the top and to start off with, I'm sorry to use Missy here, but you know, try starting on the P, because the P will at least get you a correct exposure that the camera believes you can manage handheld. And if you put it on full auto, then the camera will do the ISO as well as, but be aware of the fact that you're going to get grainy images if it's low light. But if you're up to turning the dial to TV or the dial to full program or automatic mode, we'll start you off.
Can I just come back and thank Chris, sir, because he might have stumbled across it. A lot of these cameras that use image stabilization in the body, if there's something wrong with that, you're going to get a fuzzy, as you put it, picture, and there's nothing you can do about it. I had an image stabilizing lens that, because it's sort of auto image stabilized, if I had it on a tripod, it never had a problem because the lens wasn't trying to do anything because it was so steady, it knew it was on a tripod. But if you've got a fault with your image stabilization, even if everything else is right, if the image stabilization isn't working properly, it's going to be vibrating whilst you're taking the picture and it will be out of focus. It will be fuzzy. So I would turn the image stabilization to off and then try it, because you might actually have a fault with that.
Okay.
Or maybe it was accidentally turned off, so it's never activating. On the other hand, maybe it does work.
I'm not sure you've got a firmware option for that.
Yeah,
I don't think you've got option for that in the menus on the G9. Right, last question. Hi, guys. I met someone today who wanted to understand the intelligence of an image, or perhaps the essence of the starting points of good images. I told them about rule of thirds, as this was all I could think of, but I wondered if the panel had three things which they would say are the essence of any good picture. Three things, no second bites. Away you go, Mr. Forsman.
Three things, you say...
Right, you've had your chance. Next one.
Oh, okay.
We'll come back to you. Kevin?
Well, there, you know, in black and white, there's five things, and it's line, texture, shape, volume, and contrast. In color, it's a whole different game. But again, I'm in the portrait world. With me, the three most important things are expression, body language, and composition.
Good ones. Mr. Fox?
Right. All right, you've got composition. I'd say the focal point, the actual what in the image is sharp and what in the image you've used your aperture to take out of focus. I think that's an important one. And also, you know, what you're trying to say with a picture. Has it got any emotional content? Has it got, you know, is it a story? Is it what? You know, do it that way. But yeah, they're my main things: composition, focal point, and you know, what it's about.
Mr. Forsman?
I mean,
good God, Forsman.
Stop it. Making it worse.
Do you want me to do it after the UK 2 ad?
Yeah. Rule of thirds is I mean, it's such a good one. I'm just trying to think of a rule of thumb I could add to that. I would say look at the background. Because people always ignore the background. They don't think what's behind the subject. They just look at the subject, take the picture, and there's always just some annoying element or something awkward or dumb, and they could have just moved 2 feet to the left or crunched down a little bit and looked up or something like that and really gotten a better shot by paying attention to what's in the background. So
There's one other thing is direction blind.
Go on. I said one bite of the cherry, Mr. Newsom, but go on.
Direction of light, I think, is a huge piece of the puzzle when it comes to just about anything. You can change the look, feel, and mood of an image by changing the direction of light. And if you're working with available light, that simply means changing your own perspective of what you're photographing. You know, backlighting or coming into where the light's hitting something at 3/4 profile is really a very pleasing look in just about any kind of photography.
Yeah, I mean, I always get a kick in for doing it, but I always talk about the physics of it first, because your composition doesn't make anything unless you've got the physics of capturing the light right in the first place. You can have bright images which are underexposed and dark images which are still underexposed. So you've got to think about your contrast range. You've got to think about the physics of getting the light in and being captured in the medium. And once you've got that color balance, contrast right, and the image then is exposed correctly, then your artistic values like rules of thirds and those kind of things, Fibonacci sequence, spirals and that kind of thing will come into it. But think about the physics first. Get the image captured right first and then start thinking about your composition from that, because without the exposure, the whole image is utterly lost. Right. This podcast and all the others wouldn't be possible without UK2. They keep us afloat. They kick up all the bandwidth. There's tons of codes that you can get that'll give you lots and lots of money off all the stuff that you can buy from them. Go to our website, britishtechnetwork.com, and then click on their logo and it'll take you through to their website. And then when you buy anything, if you use the offer codes that you can find on the sponsors link back on our page, then we'll get credit for them. We don't get any money. We just get the kudos for having sent you. They pick up all our bandwidth, 24 terabytes of it last month, which was pretty fantastic. Please support UK2, because by doing that, you support us and you keep us afloat. Thanks very much for their support and sponsorship. We'd be lost without them. Right then, fellas, last bit. Where can we get a hold of you, Mr. Forsman?
You can get a hold of me at arstechnica.com. And I'm also on the Twitters at Forsmac.
Some great articles last week, mate. Well done. Shame you didn't come on the Mac show. Because we talked about your articles.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That must have been why my ears were so hot.
They were. But you're on Mac show today, aren't you, so?
Mm-hmm.
We shall see you back in a moment. Mr. Newsom, where can people get a hold of you?
Kevin at newsomsstudio.com or on Twitter at newsomsstudio.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Mr. Fox?
Alex G. Fox on Twitter.
Good man. And you still got twitterything.com?
I just renewed it. I realised I've had it a whole year and done bugger all with it.
still got nothing on it. I'm Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. You can get me at ewanrankin.co.uk for commercial photography. But my website has had to be moved over because it lapsed from where it was. So I need to do a new website. I've got to upload it yet. Sorry. But I haven't had the time. See you again soon. Thanks for listening, and Max shows next.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.